Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope you had a wonderful weekend. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we have a lot to get to in today's show, so let's get right to it. Coming up after the break, two Grammy winners, Joe Henry and Mike Reed, team up for an album called Life and Time, a gentle, poetic collaboration born of friendship and grace, and also a moving story of family and resilience. A 13-year-old girl watches as her mother is taken away in handcuffs, leaving their lives suspended between two countries. Ahead is a story of tamales, tears, and determination. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein with my friend Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota and a passionate public philosopher. He hosts the popular public radio show Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life, where he tackles big questions about everyday life. And he's also the author of books and dozens of articles, often finding practical ways to bring philosophy into daily conversations. And this Friday, October 24th at 1:30 p.m. on the campus of Minot State University, he'll address a topic on many minds, civil discourse in contentious times. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
I am happy to be here always, and this is a topic that is dear to my heart, but deeply complex, and one never knows where it ends up.
I'm guessing, Jack, that you'll explore how we might find common ground on tough topics sometimes that we can either use your advice at the dinner table or with our colleagues or maybe even at work. It's essential, I believe, for a healthy democracy. So tell me, your lecture is titled Civil Discourse in Contentious Times. What do you hope people will take away from your talk?
Well, the first thing I want to point out is that, as you well know, I'm a philosopher. And because I'm a philosopher, nothing I'm going to say is going to be straightforward or give us any definitive concrete answers, right? My job is to pose questions and get people to become more uncertain than they are when they walk into the room. And so part of what I'm going to do is get people to, I don't know what the term would be to reflect on what their expectations are for offensiveness and what their expectations are for appropriateness. The title, Civil Discourse in Contentious Times, includes vague words. What does civil mean? What does discourse mean? What does contentious mean? And before we really understand the solution to these problems, we really have to understand the ambiguities that we're working with.
You know, Jack, we've talked about this before in this era of social media and news outlets that bend either to the left or to the right. They thrive on outrage. They get paid to make me mad and to make you mad at someone else, it seems to me. What do you see as the biggest challenges then about having, well, civil conversations across our differences?
I think you've hit the nail on the head, because we really are addicted to outrage, and our bodies are predisposed to find those chemical reactions. Very interestingly, the science of social networks point out that it's not that we're addicted to the likes and the follows that we get, it's that we're addicted to the anticipation of them, that the chemical reactions in our brain that happen while we are anticipating, while we are waiting for responses, is actually what gives us the jolt of pleasure and what keeps us attentive to our social networks. And so this is the same thing in a different context, because people are going to be sitting there and they're going to be wondering, what is he going to say? Am I going to react negatively? I deal with this with my students all the time. I put a text in front of them and they read it to disagree. They don't read it to understand. They don't read it to be generous. They don't read it to learn about the world. They're reading it to say, how am I reacting to this statement, to this point of view? Where can I find a crack in their argument so I can insist upon my point of view? And that sets us up for conflict. It sets us up for lack of understanding. It sets us up for the worst arguments that go the fewest places.
Jack, some people, including me, believe the deck is stacked against you when you try to bring this conversation to us, to Minot State University students, faculty, and staff. Do you feel that's true? And what can people do? You don't want to give advice. You want us to think, but what do you hope people feel then if they want to push back against this concept of, nope, we want to stay divided?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And I can interpret it in a bunch of different ways, including it's stacked against me personally, in part because I'm a philosophy professor and we are under surveillance right now and universities are targets for attack right now. I can think of it in terms of me as a media personality and the suspicion that journalists have and that folks on public radio are faced with because people, I think mistakenly, regard it as a far left outlet. And then there's also the outsider coming in aspect. Why do we have to listen to this guy? There's suspicion of students versus teachers just because they don't want to be there. They'd rather be somewhere else, right? There's all of these factors stacked against us. And so I think the things that I have to do in the very beginning are to communicate a sense of trust and authenticity, that I am here being vulnerable, that I am here being honest, that I am here not to make you believe what I believe, but to enjoy the pleasure of investigation and the social excitement of inquiry, and make it about the collective experience of being humans in the same room. One of the first things I'll say in the lecture, those of you who are used to listening to me on the radio know that I almost talk everything out spontaneously, that most of my stuff is unscripted, except for the monologue of the show. I am scripting this. I am writing this down. This is a formal lecture that I am being very careful about with every word and every idea. And my wife is going to look at it and edit it. And it's the real deal. And what I want people to understand is that I take them and their point of view so seriously that I am doing all of the work in advance to give them the respect and the dignity that they deserve. That my job is not to come in and tell them what to believe, and my job is not to represent a political point of view. My job is to give them the opportunity to explore ideas that we are often too busy, too anxious, and too buried under baggage to really give the attention that we deserve. You had said in the beginning that maybe we might find common ground, and this too is a choice. It is easy to have civil discourse when we have common ground. The question is, how do we have civility when we have uncommon ground and when we're deeply divided? Can't we still be a community when we disagree? And those are the central framing themes that I have to navigate.
Friend of mine, former senator in Wyoming, who's now deceased, Senator Mike Enzi, often talked about, look, let's not worry about the 10% of things that we don't agree upon, because maybe there's no solution for us to come together to have a nice civil discussion because we are so divided. But you know what? 90% of the stuff we agree on, let's focus on those. In that context, where does your lecture sit?
This is also a theme that I bring into my classes, because it is very common for students to say, everyone has a different opinion on everything. And that's, of course, not true. 90%, I would actually probably say even more, of things we agree on. We agree on silly things like you have to wear clothes when you go to work. And we agree on things like the highways should be constructed well enough so that when you take a turn, you don't go off the rails, right? We agree on we want food to be safe. We agree that we want to be warm in the winters. One of the wonderful experiences being in North Dakota, and this was the entry into the community. When you experience this, you know you're here. It's the middle of the winter. You are stuck on a road in the snow, and you're revving your tires and nothing is happening. And all of a sudden, out of the mist, these men come. They're almost always men. And they don't say anything, and they just push your car. And you drive away. And if you get stuck again, they'll be there again. And they'll push the car, and they don't say anything. And you drive away, and they don't get mad, and they don't get upset, and they don't make fun of you. And then you find yourself being one of those people. Right. And I've done it with women as well as men, and my wife have done it, but it tends to be men in this culture. You find yourself getting out of the car and pushing someone else's car and watching them go away without having any social interaction. That underpins the fact that we are a unit before we are competitors. We are a community before we are oppositional. And so the question becomes, how do we create a group comfort so that we can debate and disagree about that 10 or 5%, so that we can honestly feel differently about different things without knocking down the whole edifice, without driving down? I mean, I cannot think of a single North Dakotan who would be driving down the highway, who would see someone stuck on the side of the road and say, I'm not going to push them because I don't agree with their politics. That doesn't fit the character of the people. So how do we recreate that and acknowledge it in a context in which we are open to disagreement and passion and fear and deep anxiety, but still regard each other with respect and dignity? That's the question of how we find civil discourse in contentious times.
My guest in our conversation is with Jack Russell Weinstein. He's giving a lecture this Friday, October 24th at 1:30 p.m. on the campus of Minot State University. And the topic is civil discourse in contentious times. Jack, you don't want to give advice, but tell us maybe what we should think about to engage more civilly in our daily lives, whether it's face-to-face. A couple practical tools maybe you're going to give your guests at your lecture to think about.
Well, I will give some advice, although I'm not going to give advice until the end, until they know where I'm coming from. But one simple piece that I'll talk about at the end is this. When you are talking with someone, it is best to gauge your energy level and your approach to the conversation based on the way that they're acting. If they're talking slowly and they're being very reflective and they're being cautious and, you know, lots of breaks between words, you do the same thing. You meet their level, you meet their passion. I'll ruin a joke in the lecture, but I'll say, you know, when I get really excited, I curse a lot. It's the New Yorker in me. And if I'm having a serious debate with someone and I get excited and I do that and they're offended by it, if they bristle at that, I'm going to lose them. I'm going to lose their trust. I'm going to lose the comfort, and we're going to lose the flow. And so what I have to recognize is, how can I be in order to let them be who they are? And the philosophical insight there is that when we engage in serious debate or controversy with another person, it is much more productive to let them set the tone than for us to insist upon the tone. And if both people are continually looking towards the other person to set the tone, then both people are inherently respecting and acknowledging and empathizing, and those are the preconditions. The details of the debate are rarely what's at stake. What's at stake is the emotion, What's at stake is the philosophical conviction. What's at stake is the question that many people ask, which is, am I being judged? Am I being condemned? And when you do something simple like attend to just their rhythm and their way of speaking, you are showing them that you see and hear them, and you're letting them set the terms of the discussion.
Jack, you're giving this lecture at a public university. I want you to talk about the role of universities for discussions like this. But in my mind, I'm having this little thought that why aren't these discussions held elsewhere? Case in point, I'm from Wyoming. I used to sit and watch hour after hour after hour of debate in the Wyoming legislature. And a decade ago, it was somewhat civil. Wouldn't it be great if they could spend 5 minutes a day talking about just what you talked about and then moving on with their business?
There are so many reasons why that has disappeared. The first is that most of these conversations now take place in town halls, and town halls are partisan events. The second is that the people who we look towards to role model these kinds of behavior on news, on cable news and on podcasts and things like that, they're selling their brand before they're engaging in a discussion. They want to appear to be a certain kind of person. I would love for these things to be more prevalent. In fact, once a month in the East Grand Forks Library, I host a senior citizens philosophy discussion group where we talk about some of the most contentious issues there are. We've asked, you know, why there's evil in the world. We asked whether empathy is important. There's a whole host and everyone's invited. You don't have to be a senior citizen. It's free. You can come from all over North Dakota and Minnesota. Second Monday of every month, the Campbell Library in East Grand Forks, come join us and have wonderful, friendly conversation. We've been doing it for about 12 years and everyone just loves each other. So it can happen. The reason why it is sequestered in universities is that a university, a college, a school is a place where we are supposed to learn, and learning means trial and error. Learning means experimenting and failing. This is why we see college students and high school students, a couple years into their time there, they change all the clothes that they wear, or they change the music they listen to, or they do a radically different thing with their hairstyle, or they walk away from friends that they've had for 10 years and discover new friends. They're trying on new identities. They're trying new experiences, and some of those will be safe and some of those will be unsafe. Some of those will succeed and some of those won't succeed. The goal of a university, of any school institution, to give people the skills they need to think for themselves and to engage these ideas in a healthy way. One of my favorite quotes, a colleague said it to me years ago. For a year, I taught in a neo-fundamentalist Christian college in Kentucky. And one of my colleagues said, and he was quoting someone else, but I don't know who, he said, "Education is what is left after they've forgotten everything you've taught them." And I find this very moving because, you know, I give my students assignments and they have to remember philosophers' names and they have to know the definition of this term and they have to know about this argument. They're not going to remember that in 6 months. They're not going to remember that in 5 years. What they are going to remember are skills and attitudes and experiences that give them the capacity to represent themselves and their own ideas and engage others with dignity when they encounter these different and sometimes challenging ideas. So a university is supposed to be a place of controversy and conflict, but it's supposed to be a place of controversy and conflict where people are safe and can experiment, and where saying something or making a mistake isn't going to ruin the rest of their lives.
I reflect back in the 1980s when Face Off was on the Mutual Broadcasting System every day for about 8 years, first with Ted Kennedy, a Democrat from Maryland, and then Bob Dole, a Republican from Kansas, and then later Al Simpson from Wyoming. And it's often remembered, Jack, you and I talked about this off mic, as civil, good-humored debate during an era when both men could disagree vigorously, but respectfully. And that's the word I think that often gets lost. Respectfully.
I think that's right. And there is a conversation to be had about what it means to respect other people and how you communicate that respect. But certainly, discourse has broken down in our society. Discourse is broken down in our amongst our legislators and our other representatives, but it's also broken down neighbor to neighbor. And we are very suspicious with one another right now. Social trust, that's what scholars call it. Social trust is the foundation of a democracy. We're often taught, and we like to believe, that a democracy is strong or weak depending on its relationship, the relationship between its citizens and its government. But that's not the primary relationship in democracy. The primary relationship in democracy is between the people and the social trust. And it doesn't matter how good or bad a government might be. If the social trust dissipates, everything falls apart. And that's what we are experiencing right now. We wonder what our neighbor is doing. We wonder where they come from. We wonder what their attitudes are. We're putting flags of our ideologies outside to show off what we believe politically. And there was a time when I think most people in this country would say, yes, I don't like whatever, Democrats, Republicans, communists, for some people, Black people or women, but my neighbor Ben is a good guy. And yeah, he's a Democrat, but I'm happy to mow his lawn if he gets sick. I'll buy his daughter's Girl Scout cookies, and I'll be happy for his successes, and I'll be sad for his failures, because we are neighbors and we are partners. The philosopher John Rawls argues that being in a society is an agreement to share each other's fate. I really like that imagery, and it represents well this interaction between the person and their neighbor, Ben, whoever that is. If we could get back to that point, if we could get back to the point where I don't know and I'm a little suspicious of your politics or your religion or whatever else, you know, your food smells kind of funny to me, but I know that you are my neighbor and I love my neighbor. And I know that you are my friend and partner, and I can trust you. And if something happens, if I'm having a heart attack and my 7-year-old daughter runs next door and says, my dad is having a heart attack, you will be there, you will get the doctor, and you will protect my daughter as long as necessary until I am well enough to protect her myself. We have to find that kind of connection, and we've lost it. And I hope that the kind of conversation that I'll be leading in Minot is the kind of conversation that will put one little brick in the rebuilding of that edifice.
His conversation is titled Civil Discourse in Contentious Times. You can hear Jack Russell Weinstein this Friday, October 24th at 1:30 p.m. on the campus of Minot State University. Jack, best wishes with your lecture.
Thank you very much, and I hope to see everyone there and anyone who is listening. Please come up and say hello. Let me know you listen on public radio and let me know you heard this. I'm always happy to talk to people who hear me on the radio.
You going to have a Q&A, Jack?
Yes, we are going to have a Q&A. Where at least half the time is going to be devoted to that, so there'll be plenty of time. I'm going to be meeting with the students privately afterwards for a coffee, but I'll be around, and if there isn't enough time to talk to people then, I am always happy to come back. I'm always happy to travel the state and meet groups and have these conversations. It's one of my favorite things about living here.
Still ahead on Main Street, a story of tamales, tears, and determination. Right after this news. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Two Grammy Award-winning musicians team up for a sparse but richly rewarded listen on the new album, Life and Time. Mike Reed, who once chased quarterbacks for a living and known for writing a string of Nashville hits, and Joe Henry, a gifted songwriter, he wrote Madonna's Don't Tell Me, took home gold for helming a record by soul blues great Simone Burke keep things on the down-tempo. But as you'll hear in this artist spotlight, there's excitement in the little moments.
Okay, let's see how we can explain this collaboration. A former Cincinnati Bengal lineman who wrote 12 number one hits and these gems. Latter for which he won a Grammy, and this Grammy award-winning in-demand producer, impressionistic jazz folk player, Into the Music with Mike Olson mainstay, and Madonna's brother-in-law. This time I'm not coming down. This was my country, this frightful land, this angry land. Yep, that was Joe Henry, and before that, Mike Reed. They have paired up for Life and Time. A collection of piano-driven melodies awash in the typical understated arrangements that Joe Henry is known for. Joe wrote the words, Mike the music, and he takes the lead vocals throughout. The two came together at a Rodney Crowell songwriting camp, and here's one of the results, the title track, Life and Time.
I went north when trouble came, thought it stayed behind. Working my way through Michigan, finally crossed the line. I made my peace with solitude as years pushed on and by, but held your face as grace itself upon my life and time.
This album requires some time on your part and attention, but each brushstroke of a lyric and each subtle, never-wasted note deepens your connection to one of America's greatest and largely unknown songwriters, Joe Henry, and a former NFL football player turned hit songwriter, Mike Reed, who recently told a publication that he had this kind of physical experience when singing Joe Henry's lyrics. His mind and his body believed them.
I'd barely let the daylight through when the whole of the world walked in with you. Weather all around me rose, alive beyond my dream, the one by which you seem to live beyond. Beyond me too, the whole of the world rose up with you.
So Joe and Mike recorded this album with no plans, no agendas, just two otherworldly talents charting a new course for sublime, richly rewarding listening. So spend some time with Life and Time by Mike Reed and Joe Henry, maybe on a fall North Dakota drive, and catch some of their tunes on Into the Music with Mike Olson. That's weekdays 9 to 10 a.m. and again from noon to 6 right here on member-supported Prairie Public. You could listen to online at prairiepublic.org via a smart speaker or Prairie Public app.
Tears have found my face and hands, a shadow finds the heart. As every journey holds the grief of ending at its start. To love is to surrender, willing now to fall. To disappear and be the greater victor of us all. Here's a little that I have, it's more than what I know. Voice of time that breaks in mind and will not let you go. Will not let you go.
You can hear Joe Henry frequently on Into the Music with Mike Olson. Joe's work has been a staple of the show for 30 plus years. Listen weekdays from 9 to 10 a.m. and again from noon to 6 p.m. on Prairie Public.
Dakota Pro Musica is presenting their first concerts of their sixth season, October 25th and 26th, in Cannonball and Bismarck. The Sacred Place concerts explore our relationship with nature and creation from both a native and non-native perspective. The concerts include choral and instrumental music, Lakota drum songs performed by a youth ensemble from Woju, Lakota poetry, and more. For more information on the concerts or tickets, you can find Dakota Pro Musica on Facebook or go to dakotapromusica.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. When we think of deportation, we might picture a one-time event. You get caught, then they put you on a plane, and that's it. But a deportation order can take months or even years to process. So we look at the story of one family living in deportation limbo, published by KUOW, as part of their series, Between Worlds, Behind Bars.
My name's Sadie. I'm 13. I go to Mount Baker Middle School.
Sadie's sitting in the hallway of St. Matthew's Church in Auburn after Sunday services. She's telling me the story of the time her mom was arrested 2 summers ago.
Well, I was with her, so I was crying. It was the day we got kicked out of our house, so yeah, it was really sad. We were trying to move everything to the storage place, which was 3 blocks away, but apparently one of the taillights wasn't working, so there was a cop behind us and stopped her for it.
Sadie was afraid of what would happen if her mom was arrested.
They maybe take her to Mexico, so I was scared.
Sadie's mom was arrested, and they took her to the Auburn City Jail. But when they found out her mom was an illegal immigrant, they sent her to the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. She stayed there for 6 weeks. Eventually, her church was able to raise $10,000 for her bond. This was June 2008. The deportation case is still going on. Sadie's mom could be deported at any time. Sadie lives with her mom and 3 brothers in a small house near downtown Auburn, about 30 miles south of Seattle.
Hola. ¿Cómo están? Muy
bien. Gabriela Cubillos is Sadie's mom. She goes by Gabby. Gabby speaks a little English, but she's more comfortable in Spanish. Every Saturday, she makes a couple hundred tamales to sell at church the next day.
Se le pone ajo, cebolla, y ya cocido, se muele.
First, Gabby stews chicken or pork with onions and chili. She prepares a dough from cornmeal and lard, and she tries to keep the kids out of the kitchen. Gabby's 32. She's got 4 kids. Her youngest son was born here, so he's a U.S. citizen, but everyone else is undocumented. Before Gabby got arrested, she had a job cleaning office buildings. She worked at night so she could be with her kids during the day. But ever since she got out of the detention center, she hasn't been able to find a new job. So now Gabby's living her whole life in a kind of gray area. Immigration knows she's here illegally, but they're allowing her to stay while she fights her deportation case. The problem is that any work she finds would technically be illegal. So she's stuck in this limbo.
I never thought I would be making tamales. But when I got out of immigration, I didn't have a job. I didn't have anything. Then one day at the church, there was a lady selling tamales, and they were so bad. They were really salty. So I called up my mom and had her tell me how to make them. And then I started making my own. My mom had always told me that I should learn.
Gabby grew up in a tiny town in Mexico. There were maybe 100 houses. No telephone, no money. She ran away from home to join the army when she was 16 so she could pay for her siblings to go to school. But after a few years, she wanted out. She had 3 small children by then. A sister had moved to Texas, and Gabby thought she could give her kids a better life there. So she decided to try for the border. In the late 90s, when Gabby left Mexico, she says you just got on a bus headed for the States and hoped they didn't decide to check IDs that day. Gabby has a pretty established life here. All of her kids switch between English and Spanish like it's nothing. They fit in at their public schools. Gabby's told the kids she might be deported, but she's also tried to shelter them. Sadie doesn't even know whether she's a citizen.
I don't know. I came here when I was young, I guess, and I lived here. I kind of grew up here, so I wonder.
Gabby has tried for a bunch of different visas. She'll go into court and say she's putting together an application for, say, the visa for victims of human trafficking or the one for victims of crimes. Gabby did have to file a restraining order on a couple that was harassing her, so it seemed like she had a good chance. Each time Gabby takes one of her visa ideas to court, she has to scrap together $500 or more for a lawyer. But each court appearance buys her a little more time. So far, though, she just hasn't been able to get the paperwork together to actually submit an application. Gabby's running out of options. She'll probably be deported by the end of the year. She says she's been fighting so hard because she wants her kids to be able to stay.
Entonces, mi pregunta es para
No sé, para los de migración.
So the question is one for immigration, I guess. Do you even know who you're kicking out and sending to Mexico? It's the future of this country. I have four futures for this country. And if I have to go, all four have to leave.
Technically, the kids would be allowed to stay here if Gabby's sent back to Mexico. But they wouldn't have anywhere to go. Right now, the family's living in a certain amount of denial. They don't have much of a choice. The kids still have to get up in the morning to go to school. Gabby still got to make tamales and try to feed everyone. The threat of deportation has been hanging in the air for so long now that you get the sense that Sadie is just ready for it all to be over.
Well, I want to go to Mexico, so if she has to go, I'll go with her, and I'll start a new life there. I think it's better to be raised there than here, because we're not going to live in a city. We're going to live, like, in our ranch place, where it's just like our family, nothing bad a lot.
If Sadie's mom is sent to Mexico, she'll be one of more than 10,000 people deported from the Pacific Northwest and Alaska over the past year. That's a number that's more than doubled since 2005. Gabby's story is just one in a huge and complicated political debate.
I think the best way to look at the way this breaks down is elitist versus sort of the common people.
Ira Melman is the media director for FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. He says there are some people whose lives aren't really affected by immigration.
Their jobs really aren't affected. Their kids are not going to schools where half the kids in the class don't speak English. So for them, it is easy to take sort of that view, well, you know, it's all kind of great because now I can go have my choice of ethnic restaurants.
FAIR's position is that we should tighten up the borders, make it more difficult to employ undocumented workers, and reduce overall levels of legal immigration. Ira says those policies would help protect the standard of living for Americans.
It is the people who are working on the construction sites who have seen their wages stagnate or decline. It's the people whose kids are in school where a lot of the resources have to be devoted simply to getting the kids up to speed in English. And it's not the fault of the kids for needing an education, but again, we don't recognize the impact that it has on the social institution that is our school system.
Gabby thought of one more way to try and stay in the country. She heard that if you've lived here for 10 years without being caught by immigration, you can apply for permanent residency. Gabby first came to the U.S. in June of 1998, exactly 10 years before she was arrested in Auburn. So this past December, she gathered up her paperwork and headed back to court. Before the hearing, Gabby and her lawyer huddled in the little consultation room. They poured dimes into the Xerox machine, copying pay stubs and notes from old bosses and friends vouching for Gabby and her 10 years spent in the United States. In the courtroom, they handed everything over to the judge. Gabby listened through an interpreter as the judge reviewed her application. He noticed that back in the fall of 98, the family had gone to Mexico for a long visit. And that's against the rules. You can't ever leave the country for more than 90 days when you're making this kind of case. The judge denied the application.
I have 30 days to appeal my decision. After that, it could take up to a year. We're going to do everything we possibly can. Today, we needed more paperwork. This is what we're going to try and do in the next 30 days. Let's hope for something good.
The immigration debate is heating up. And the rules about how someone like Gabby can become a U.S. citizen could change completely over the next few months. So all the stalling, the visa applications, the angling for just a little more time, they could pay off in the end. For now, Gabby will stick it out in limbo for a little while longer. I'm Jessica Partnow for KUOW.
Jessica Partnow is a co-founder of the Common Language Project, a new media nonprofit based at the University of Washington. You can visit clpmag.org for more from the Common Language Project, and funding for this story was provided by the KUOW Program Venture Fund.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Many remember a few crazy things happened in college, right? They probably were not things you'd want, say, an employer to know, but When gathering old buds, there's nothing better than reminiscing about the sometimes death-defying knucklehead stuff you got away with. From the September version of the Tell, Fargo's live storytelling event, Paul Kohler recalled a friend he nicknamed Super Steve.
I grew up in western North Dakota. We had a tight-knit family. We had a little, some tragedy, and I grew up with parents that wanted to make sure you were safe all the time. We had earlier curfews than most people our age when we were growing up, and it was frustrating, but we did all right. I went to school at NDSU then in about 1979, so it was over 45 years ago, and I had my first taste of independence. And I was living in Stockbridge Hall, and if you are familiar with college life, you kind of get thrown in with the people you get thrown in with. And so I ended up with a lot of friends that were very different than I was, and I was tasting my first freedom of my life, and I was enjoying it. Well, this story happens one evening in late winter, maybe early spring, because it was Lent and I wasn't drinking, so I was a designated driver. Had it not been Lent, I'd have been driving anyway. We took the, at the time it was either a 1964 Chevrolet. We could have had 8 people in that one, but if it was the next year, it was like a 73 Buick Electra, we could have probably put 15 in that one. But I was a driver, so we all piled in, and there was Steve from Milbank. He is the hero in this story, but there was Perry from Oaks and Johnny the Snowman. We actually called him that because he could get us drugs. He was from Ashley. Kevy Cat was from Elbow Lake, Minnesota. You know, it was just everybody. We piled in and we went over to Mick's office. Things haven't changed much. We were all drinking. I think when the bar got closed, I wasn't drinking, but they said we were all piling out a little one after the other. When they said, Steve's doing his thing, Steve Cat's doing his thing, and he's over by the train. Well, right behind Mick's office, there's the train track, and the train comes regularly, I guess, and one of his things was he liked to stand by the train, see how close he could get. Well, Steve was a lanky, 6'2". He had this full afro, high forehead, interesting character, but made a lot of poor decisions. He was out there standing by the train, and I was pretty much just watching him and praying that he wouldn't get hit by the train. And then my friend started yelling, Steve got hit by the train! So I ran over, and he's on the ground. I pull out a handkerchief, and I cover up his forehead where he had been hit. Something was hanging off the train and hit him in the head. And he's got this nasty gash. I'm covering it up, and I was like, okay, I'm going to pull this up and see what happens. And I pull it up, and there's blood splurts. And it's like, this is bad. This is bad. We got to get him. We got to get him to the ER. And everyone that came is with us. And, you know, we got to put 6 people back in this car and throw Steve in the back seat, laying down. So we got like 4 of us sitting in the front seat. And everyone's got, go this way, go that way. The quickest way to get to the Fargo ER. Ironically, we went around the train crossing guards because the train was coming. But we were in a hurry. So we ended up going to the ER in Fargo, and we all pile out and go in, and this is our friend. He got hit by a train. So there's about 4, 5, 6 of us sitting in the waiting room, and one of the things they had in there were their pamphlets. They also had Mr. Yuck stickers. And so we took all these Mr. Yuck stickers, and we plastered them all over us, and we looked like a bunch of idiots, and we're waiting for our friend to get stitched up. But the first person we see comes out is this cop, a Fargo police officer, and he looks at us and he says, well, who do we have here? And he says, that's your friend in there? And I said, yes. I was doing all the talking. I was the sober one with Mr. Yuck stickers all over me. So what happened to your friend? He said, got hit by a train. He said, how did that happen? I said, well, he was standing too close. I mean, that's what happened. It sounded like a smart answer, but that's what I told him. And he says, what's your friend's name? And he says, Steve. That's not what he's telling us. So, yeah, he didn't want to have insurance issues with his family. But we finally got to take him home. They had wrapped this bandage around him. He had like 22 stitches, big splotch of blood on here. He left it that way for about 4 days, walking around campus. I got to be famous as the roommate of the guy who got hit by the train. And my parents, after they heard this story, I mean, they were wondering a lot about my choice of friends, and this this one about did it. But that was Super Steve, more powerful than a locomotive. Thank you.
That's Paul Kohler and the story about his daredevil friend, Steve. The takeaway is, don't try this at a local watering hole near train tracks, okay? The train usually wins. The Tell is a monthly live storytelling event in downtown Fargo. The next show at the 4 and 4 above Side Street Grill and Pub is Thursday, November 13th at 7 p.m. Information is at the Tell's Facebook page and on Instagram.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 20th. Over six decades, Miss Briggs was likely the most frequently mentioned name in the Wahpeton papers. Never married, she was a successful businesswoman and an early adopter of the automobile. Her road trips, both regional and coast to coast, were often reported. She drove to World's Fairs in Chicago, San Diego, and Buffalo. On this date in 1924, she was enjoying an extended trip through five western states. She came to Dakota Territory from Wisconsin in 1880 with $150 loaned by her father, John F. Briggs, a Civil War veteran and Uncle Sam portrayer. Since childhood, she'd been an expert seamstress, knitter, and decorative enthusiast. Ladies' hats were in high demand and suited her artistic interests. She opened a millinery shop, operated in several locations, then built the Briggs Block on Dakota Avenue with the upstairs devoted to physician offices. She sold it in 1911 and later operated across the avenue behind Aaron Stern's iconic men's clothing store. In 1922, she retired and had her building moved to 6th Street at the entrance to the State School of Science. It was remodeled into a beautiful home. The house was painted white with a red roof, shutters, doors, and latticework. The ornate college entrance lights showed it off to lovely effect. Miss Briggs employed over 100 girls, was active in civic and patriotic work, and made a home for her aged parents until their deaths. She remained active in church matters after giving up Sunday school work and often welcomed calls from young people and children with whom she was a great favorite. She kept several parrots in her shop and later in her home. Some even developed amusing lingual abilities. One day, a little girl from the Wahpeton Indian School stopped by to admire the pretty house and flower garden. Miss Briggs came out onto the porch with a parrot and invited her over. The girl was astonished by the gorgeous bird that could talk. Later, visitors to the school asked some girls their names and marveled at their wonderful surnames like Bluebird, Pretty Lightning, Rising Sun, Medicine Horse, Eagle Star, Dreaming Bear, and Pumpkin Flower. The little girl who had a French name proudly declared her last name was Parrot. Miss Briggs died at home in 1947, leaving several historical artifacts to the Richland County Museum, including her father's Uncle Sam portrait. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Fargo Public Library presents their Fall Into Jazz concerts featuring local jazz artists Saturdays, October 4th through the 25th, starting at 4 p.m. at the downtown main library. More information at fargolibrary.org.
And that wraps up this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, it's about focus and concentration, plus lots more. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.